It's time for Garden Talk. Jill Nadeau here. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Jean-Martin Fortier is our guest today. He's a farmer, educator, and award-winning author of the bestseller, The Market Gardener. He's a recognized authority on small-scale organic vegetable production. And we're talking with him about all things organic vegetable gardening and also taking your gardening questions and comments. Join in by calling 800-642-1234. Or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. JM, welcome to the show again.
Wow, happy to be here.
Yeah, great. I'm sorry we interrupted your lunch, but, you know, we're glad you took time. Appreciate
it's
that.
It's all good. It's all good. It's all good. I'm super excited. I was hearing the news on NPR, and it reminds me that we're neighbors because I'm in Canada.
That's right.
So it's different. Yeah.
That's right. Well, you know, how did you get involved in farming in the first place?
Wow. I grew up in the suburbs, skateboarding, snowboarding, typical teenager.
Sure.
And I knew nothing about farming. My parents weren't hippies nor farmers. And I liked ecology. I like being outside. I like the outdoors. And I started to study environmental science at university. I went to McGill in Montreal. And after 3 years of studying pretty much environmental disasters and collapses and all that was wrong with the environment, I just strongly felt that I wanted to make a positive impact, and I wanted to do something that would, you know, make the world better. And after graduating, I that's where I met my wife. We just traveled. We went to Mexico, worked on fair trade coffee farms, and that wasn't it. And then we went to New Mexico. And then we started to work building Earthships, which is autonomous homes built out of tires in the desert.
Oh,
that
yes.
was really yeah. That was really eye-opening for me.
I'll bet.
Did that for a while. And then I volunteered on a small organic farm in New Mexico. And the grower was from Quebec. He was French-Canadian. And he was just so incredible that he kind of just – his lifestyle, his leadership, his role in the community. He was like the best salad grower in the market. He was the salad king of Santa Fe. And it was just like a really positive role model for mm-hmm. me. And then I just realized that small-scale farming was creating a difference in that community. Farmers were heroes, celebrated. And I was seeing, we would do the farmer's market, and then I would count the cash box at the end. I was like, wow, Richard is making a lot of cash. And I was like, that was it. Yep. I was in.
But you decided to go back to Quebec. How come?
Well, you know, when you're from Quebec, it's like probably when you're from Wisconsin, or, you know, there's a strong pull to come back.
There is.
Especially when, you know, my wife was pregnant, and, you know, we speak French. All of these things, but you know, leaving a place like New Mexico in Santa Fe, which is a really progressive small town, really beautiful, you know, we kept meeting awesome people that were doing beautiful stuff, and then that kind of energy wasn't so present in Quebec, and especially with small-scale farming.
Sure.
And so we came home with the dream of recreating what we had seen.
So you ended up co-founding an internationally recognized micro farm. Now, what is a micro farm?
Yeah, it wasn't internationally recognized when I founded it.
I'll bet it wasn't.
But the micro farm is, we farm under 2 acres. So 2 acres being probably the size of a football field.
Mm-hmm.
And we farmed heavily those 2 acres. It's an acre and a half, actually. And we have no tractor. We use hand tools. And we bring the vegetables to a farmer's market. We have a CSA program. And we sell salad mix to the local grocery store. And, you know, we kind of called it market gardening, which was the name of how, you know, what we do now was really common before tractors became the norm in farming,
right?
Like in the 1930s and prior. And so we just kind of did that, and we did that really well. And eventually, after 2, 3, 4 years, we were getting really awesome results financially. Our farm got recognized here in Quebec as an alternative model of how to start successfully a small organic farm. And eventually, I just wrote a book that laid out everything that we do, why we do it, and why it works. And the book's been a bestseller ever since.
So you just wrote a book, just like that. I love it when you said it that way. I'm sure there was some work went into that. And it's called The Market Gardener, and it's available pretty much everywhere, I'm assuming, right?
Yeah, it's like I don't want to give a shout out to Amazon. I don't think they need it.
Probably not.
No, they don't. But that, you know, I don't know where else in Wisconsin that you can get it. But it's definitely online. It's really fun for me because it's a highly technical book. So it doesn't talk about the dream of farming or it's just like it tells you, okay, you're growing carrots, you should be, you know, cultivating 10 days after seeding, and you should be seeding them, you know, with this density. And it's just a very technical book, but for some reason, it keeps capturing the heart and the imagination of a lot of people who would like to quit their jobs and go back in the country and make a living.
Sure. Well, they need the technical information. That's what makes the dream come true, right?
That was the goal when I wrote it.
Yeah.
It was like, okay, I can be an inspiration for you because, you know, like I said, like the Salad King, Richard, was an inspiration for me. But If I'm selling the dream, you know, you really need to know how to do it.
Exactly.
It's a highly technical job.
It certainly is. It certainly is. And as far as finding the book, I think any local bookseller will be able to order it for you. So if you prefer to stay local, certainly do it that way too. So actually, we want to talk a little bit, of course, focus in on organic vegetable gardening. Just give us the basic definition between a regular garden and an organic garden.
I think most gardens are like, you know, when my parents or grandparents used to garden, they would have these big shelves of different things that have a lot of dead faces on. And it's just like you had
yes.
all sorts of chemicals that were there. And just like now you're doing vegetables without any of that.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's no reason why you want to put chemicals in your garden. You're eating the chemicals. Like, why would you want to do that? So organic farming, that's kind of the first way we kind of say that that's what we do. It's it's chemical food growing. But it also ties down to soil and how to nurture the soil, how to improve it. And it's not just like the texture of the soil. It's also how alive is your soil, because it's really the microorganisms, the whole soil web that's in the soil. The more active that is, the more nutritional your vegetables are. And there's a strong correlation between both. And so organic gardening is about growing great produce without chemicals, but also paying attention to the biology in your soil.
Because by doing that, you don't have to use the chemicals, right? You can feed them organically. You can get rid of bugs in different ways.
Yeah, well, okay. You know, the magic would be if your soil is perfectly conditioned and you're doing everything right,
okay.
You should be able to grow plants without any disease or pests.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, life being life and temperatures changing and climate change, whatever the reason, it ends up not being so miraculous all the time. So, you know, because I do this professionally, there's all sorts of mechanisms that we have, you know, using insect nets, you know, scouting for specific disease, introducing beneficial insects that fight off detrimental ones. There's all sorts of different ways, or using biopesticides, which are pesticides that photodegrade or biodegrade, locally applied. But each of these strategies are used in different contexts, for different crops, for different insects. So it ends up being, you know, quite complicated in a way.
It is. Farming is not easy.
No, nor having a vegetable. Having a vegetable garden is not easy also. A lot of people know that they plant and they're like, whoa, everything's gone the next week. And how did that happen?
How did that happen? Exactly. Exactly. So what are the basic advice you have for people who do want to grow their vegetables organically?
I would start by telling them that, you know, we grow in beds. Mm-hmm. We call them beds. So like they're 30-inch wide, soils that we don't change the bed. We don't grow the crops in rows. We grow them in beds. So there's 30-inch, and in that 30-inch, it's raised, and then we'll have 4, 5, 6, 7, 12 rows of different vegetables growing on this bed. And then there's the pathway where we circulate. That can be 12-inch or 18-inch, and then there's another bed, 30-inch. Okay, mm-hmm. So we call those bed systems. And the first line is to go that way and not rototill your whole plot every year and start over. There's no need to rototill the whole garden. What you want is to rototill, as least as possible or none at all.
Right.
That's the first kind of tip. Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. Well, we will be... Actually, we're going to take a little bit of a break, and then we'll come back and take some calls. We're talking about getting the most out of your garden with Jean-Martin Fortier. Our on-air producer today is Jana Rose Schleiss, and Tyler Ditter is our technical director. You can join in the conversation by calling 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. This is Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. We're talking about organic vegetable gardening today. Join us every Friday to listen again on Saturday mornings at 6:00. So, JM, let's just go to the phones and see what questions people have. Our first caller is Tracy, and she is in Pennsylvania. Okay, hi, Tracy.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. How are things in Pennsylvania?
Oh, it's warming up, which I'm pretty excited for. So.
What can we help you with?
Well, I'm experiencing some issues that I was hoping you could help me with my hostas. I have two beautiful hostas, and they've been in the same area for about 5 years. The one is beautiful. I mean, there's no damage or anything. And the one next to it, to the right of it, I'm noticing some damage to the leaves. Almost looks like something's eating away at it, and the leaves are turning yellow. So I'm not sure if it's something. And basically, when I planted them 5 years ago, they are in a clay-based soil, and I used fertilizer to kind of work it through and to make it, you know, a little bit more of a base for the plants.
Okay. All right, JM, is that hostas in your wheelhouse there?
Well, no, it's not in my wheelhouse because I really do more vegetables, but
sure.
I do have some at home.
Okay.
And it's a plant that I really appreciate. There's all sorts of reasons why, you know, leaves can turn yellow. Usually it's disease that are driven by either too much water or fungal disease that are starting to spread. It's a bacterial wilt or fungal wilt or an anthracnose or these kind of diseases. But, you know, to find the right remedy, what you really need to make sure is that you identify correctly what the disease is. So, you know, you should just kind of Google hosta problem and then look at the images and then trying to correlate what you see with an image and then click on that link. And then you might find what the problem is. And then that's going to tell you which remedy you can use, because there's no point in putting a fungicide, even if it's natural. There's a lot of natural fungicides out there if it's not a fungal problem. So yeah, that's my little 2 cents here.
Sure. And Tracy, I don't know about Pennsylvania, but here in Wisconsin, we have a extension service through the University of Wisconsin in each county. So we're able to contact the horticulture experts there, and they can talk you through that type of thing. Can you tell me, Tracy, what kind of holes are you talking about? Are we talking about holes or something nibbling the edges? Because you said there were holes.
Yeah, it almost looks like something's kind of nibbling away at the edges.
Okay, but just the one, not both?
Yeah, just the one hosta.
That's probably bunny rabbits, right? At least the rabbits in my area eat my hostas. So that could be a hungry rabbit. Do you have those running around?
Well, actually, I was thinking about that, but then as I was Googling and kind of, you know, doing some research on it, I was wondering if maybe something was more based at the root, and the suggestions were to maybe to try to migrate it to a different area, to try that as an alternative.
Sure.
And a transplant it. But you have to wait till the soil is completely warm, either in the fall or the early or the late spring.
Interesting. Well, good luck, Tracy. We appreciate you calling in, and hopefully you'll figure out what's going on. Thanks. Next up, we have Chris in Black Creek. Hi, Chris.
Yes, are you there?
Yes, we are. What's your question?
Okay, yes, I'm owner and operator of crystalsforkids.org. And to your guest, being in Canada, I used to, before the passport requirement, pick 30 gallons of your wonderful wild blueberries, blueberry fields forever up there by Kenora, and bring them back, throw them in the freezer, and they turn into beads, and then pack my pancakes with them. So I want to grow a blueberry patch behind my house. It's mostly in the shade here in Black Creek, Wisconsin, on that side of the house. And you know, I don't know of any organic wild blueberry plants, because I'm assuming that it would be unlawful to cut the plants out of your neighborhood up there to your guests and haul them across the border and bring them down here and plant them. And the other thing is that I noticed that up there that the forest fires is where the blueberries really thrived. You couldn't walk without making blueberry wines, and I picked them for 14 years consecutively up there. Just wonderful blueberry patches. But you know, I'm assuming that I would have to go with these hybrid plants to plant a good patch behind my house. Or is there any wild blueberry plant that I can get to start that patch with? That's my and the last thing is that, you know, once in a while, we'd notice there would be this little tiny blueberry worm inside the blueberries. Ah, heck, it didn't matter. Throw them in the freezer, put them in pancakes. You didn't know they were there. That's part of the meat. All right.
Thanks, Chris. JM, do you have any experience with the planting and cultivating blueberries?
Wild blueberries, no. Mm-hmm. And I myself do also very much appreciate them. We actually go to, there's a big lake called Lac Saint-Jean, up north from here, and also when we go to Maine, by the coast, so incredible, just love it there.
Yes,
but you know, cultivating blueberries, we do have on the farm probably 30 bushes, something like that. They do take careful planting, and you know, it's just about, first of all, for blueberries, it's about finding the right cultivars. You know, the right one for your soil and for your climate, but also for the taste, because they're not all the same.
No.
And so I would definitely, that's like the strong thing, is like to make sure that you get the right ones. And then from there, there's all sorts of specific sets. You know, they like acidic soils.
So right,
that's
they do.
Very, very, that's why they grow in the fires.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's something that needs to be carefully thought out. There's a lot of sawdust that goes around the blueberries for that reason, because they like the acidic soils.
Ah, that's a good tip right there. We have talked about blueberries on the show a number of times, and I am pretty sure that Larry has mentioned that there is a pamphlet from the Learning Store at, again, the UW Extension that you can go online and download. So, Chris, you could do that. You could go ahead and take a look at that, and they'll give you lots of tips for growing here in Wisconsin. Thanks, Chris. And let's go now to Tim, and he's in Delavan. Hi, Tim.
Hello. I have a question. You were talking about the goal is to not have to rototill your garden. I find that in my garden with the snow and the rain, it gets so hard packed by the time springtime comes around that I have to rototill. Is there, if you can expand on that goal of not rototilling, that would be helpful.
Thanks, Tim. Go ahead, Jam.
I'm really happy that somebody picked it up, because that's the whole kind of farming model that I helped develop was, okay, we're not using the rototiller, but what do we do?
Right.
And that, it took me kind of a few years to really figure that out, and, you know, probably 12 years to really master that. But, and first of all, I'll just start by saying why. Why you want to kind of move away from the rotor tiller. And it's really simple because, you know, I was talking in my intro about how soils are alive, and there's a direct relationship or correlation between nutrition and the fertility in the garden and the liveliness of the garden. So the more alive it is, the more there's earthworms, spiders, microorganisms, the more fertility there is for your plants. Okay. Mm-hmm. But when you rotor till, what you do is like if you're blowing on a fire, you're bringing a lot of oxygen into the soil, and then you're blowing hard on your fire. So it's giving a shot. It's really giving a shot of fertility, but it doesn't last long. And you can deplete your garden very fast that way. Plus, when you till, you create soil structure that's really fluffy and nice, but by tilling, you destroy all of the profiles that are there, all of the crumbliness of the soil, and then it starts to compact more. So all the soil structure gets beaten up, and then it compacts more. So if you're a home gardener and you're doing the tilling once a year, that's fine. But if you're always planting new stuff, and that every time you're planting new stuff, you're tilling everything until it's, you know, black earth and when there's no weeds and there's nothing, then you're destroying your soil structure, and then you're kind of exhausting your fertility. So the way we do it is, first of all, we replace kind of the rotor tiller with a broad fork. Okay. I don't know if your listeners know what a broad fork is, but it's a tool. Do they know? Do you think
I think maybe we call it like a manure fork or a potato fork. It's the big tines, right?
Yeah. It's the broad fork is the tool that all ecological home gardeners should have in their garden by far. And the broad fork is, it's a big fork. It's 20 inch feet wide. And it has tines that are about 10, 11 inch long. And then it has two handlebars. And then you plant that in your garden. And then with the, just by moving backward, like rowing, you're opening up the soil. The tines, they open up the soil. And that's it.
So
and
you
you're
said
not
two handlebars? I don't know if that sounds familiar. Interesting.
Yes. So people can Google it. The broad fork.
Okay.
And they'll see that they'll probably see me also using it because I'm a big advocate of the broad fork.
Mm-hmm.
And it really, what it is, it allows you to kind of open up the soil, loosening it up, but without inverting the layers, without destroying, you know, the habitat of the earthworms, and without pulverizing the soil. So kind of that's kind of the first tool. And then to kind of remove whatever's growing on the garden, weeds, you know, when you're doing a plant renewal, let's say you're going from lettuce to radishes or carrots, and then there's weeds there, we put a black tarp over the beds and we leave it there for 2-3 weeks. And then the black tarp, it's really magical. What it does is it creates somewhat of a microclimate for your microorganisms to thrive, and they end up chewing whatever's there. And then you remove the tarp, and then it's your soil is all black, all ready to go. Then you broad fork, then you rake, then you seed. So that those three things replace the rotor tiller in the garden.
Interesting. Now, what kind of a material is your tarp made out of?
It can be many things, and most, you know, most home gardeners have seen this. If you leave a flower pot somewhere or anything big enough that when you remove it, you see that, you know, the grass is not there anymore, but there's all sorts of life there.
Okay.
That's really the power of mulching. But for us in our gardens, using straw mulch is really not practical because it'd be too much straw. And so to answer your question, we use black silage tarps.
Okay.
So silage tarps are used in dairy farms. So Wisconsin's they're all over, and they're UV treated. So they can last 20 years, And so it's plastic, which most people don't like to use in their garden, but it's kind of not disposable plastic. It's something that'll last year after year after year. And the fact that it's black, what it does is that it kind of mimics, soil layering. So your earthworms, you know, they're thinking it's nighttime and they're coming up and they're chewing whatever was left on your bed and then they're bringing it back down. So they're working 24/7 at your service because you've put the black tarp there. And that's a smart way to just kind of renew your garden space.
Yeah, great. Well, thank you for that information and thank you for the call, Tim. Let's go now to Ron in La Crosse. He has some info on that broad fork. Hi, Ron.
Yes, I have a comment. Your guest talked about using a broad fork, and I think I know what he's referring to. I have one, and I bought it at a hardware store called a Garden Claw, and it's got maybe about four long prongs, two short ones in the middle, and it's got these, they look like old-type bicycle handbars, and you turn it. And it works pretty good. I guess it doesn't dig as deep as a rototilling, but that's just as well concerning what your guest had to say. I have another question, too. I have a couple of trees that seem to blare what looks like black raspberries about every other year. And last year I had a bumper crop. It was the latter half of June, first week of July. And this spring, it looked like it was going to get berries, and then it kind of fizzled out. And I just wonder if your guest knows what that type of tree that is. It only seems to really bear fruit every other spring.
Mulberry?
I'll pass on that one.
What do the fruits look like? You said it looks like a raspberry, but it's on a tree. Is that right?
Yeah, black raspberry.
Okay. Could it be a mulberry?
Maybe. I don't know.
I would check that one out. I don't know about them doing every other year, but I know that the fruit does kind of look like a raspberry. You can make jam out of them and whatnot. So that could possibly be it. I'd look that up. So thanks, Ron. Appreciate that. Next, let's go to Jenny in Green Bay. Hi, Jenny.
Hi. I have a question about my soil. I have a small 4x8 box bark garden in my yard. And the last couple of years, anytime I put in a pepper, like a bell pepper, not like hot peppers, I'll plant any random amount of variety from Walmart, from a home store, from anywhere. And then about maybe, probably about 4 weeks, the leaves just start to curl up and drop off, and then I just have a stem. And I was wondering, is that something that might be like fungal with my soil? Can I just wait and let it lie fallow for peppers and then eventually it'll come back, or should I just get new dirt? What do you think I should do?
JM?
Identifying diseases over the phone is never easy, no. I have to say. but I'd like to help anyway. Pepper leaf curl. What causes the leaves to curl? It can be different things. I wouldn't essentially think that it's something wrong with your soil. It could be just like if it's always too wet, something like that. You know, that's one thing that I see that most home gardeners, I don't want to say generally do that, but the last thing you want to do is overwater. Like your young plants, they need to have really wet soils at transplant, but after that, the roots, they need to dry up. Otherwise, they start to sog, and then it slowly kind of kills the plant, and then it'll lose its leaf. So I don't really know if that's exactly what's happening on your end, but if you don't see any pests or, you know, holes, and they're just kind of, that could be that.
Okay. Also, Jenny, you might want to send a sample or contact the Plant Disease Diagnostic Lab here at UW-Madison. Dr. Death, Brian Huddleston, is in charge of that. You can just Google that, and you'll be able to see how to contact them. So that's another good option for you if you want to try to figure out what's going on with those bell peppers. Those are kind of hard to grow, aren't they, Jam?
Yeah, they're not easy. There's a lot of things that can go wrong.
Mm-hmm.
They're definitely easier than harder than tomatoes, but it's really about establishing them well. And you know, the peppers, they need a lot of fertility, especially when they're young,
mm-hmm.
to really kick. And so in her instance, what I would do if she has more than one plant, I'd just kind of dig it up to see how the roots are doing. So usually there's a lot of the rooting of the plant after the first month that it's established is really important. That's why the soils need to be open and loose. And that's why there needs to be just the right balance of fertility, not too much and enough. And for that, each plant is different. But yeah, they're tough, but you know what? Like peppers, we make a lot of money with them, so I really enjoy them.
Okay. Well, we're talking about organic vegetable gardening with Jean-Martin Fortier. If you've got a question or a comment, please join the conversation. We have a couple of open lines. 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And speaking of emails, we did get one from Vicky. She is growing sugar snap peas. The vines vary from 2 to 6 feet and different sizes and different types of pods. Now, the tall vines are done producing, but the short vines have blossoms. And Vicky got a variety of sizes and types of mature peas. Is this the reason for the disparity? Some are short, some are tall. Some I've already, I would assume so, right?
That's a great question. Like sugar snap, oh my God, they're so good.
These are,
every gardener should have them in there. I don't know if it's the basics is that you need to harvest them every second day.
Mm-hmm.
They're all growing at different cycles, and you start with the bottom and you move up your plant, but there's going to be some others coming up all the time. So when it's your production is really kicking in, you need to harvest every second day to make sure that you're taking them at the right moment, just before, you know, they start to kind of bulk too much, and when they're tasty. So the trick is to taste as many as possible to know when they're really ripe.
What a rough job, huh? Tasting all those sugar snap peas. Yeah, I mean, Vicky, if they maybe just be growing slower, so that's good. You've stretched out your harvesting time, so that's a good thing. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Carol and Crandon on the line. Hi, Carol.
Hi, thank you. I have a question about tomatoes. I have 10 very large tomato plants that I purchased from a private nursery that I really like in Rhinelander, Wisconsin. They're very healthy, loaded with lots of flowers, and are beginning to get small tomatoes forming. In the last 4 or 5 days, I've noticed some yellowing of a small amount of leaves at the base of some of the plants, and I know leaf wilt is a problem with tomatoes. Is there anything I can do to try to slow down that process since it seems to be starting?
Great. Can I take this one?
Absolutely.
I love tomatoes, and it's really fantastic when they start to kick. I would say, at the risk of repeating myself, usually when tomato leaves turn yellow, it's because they're usually overwatered. Either underwatered, which is rarer because we tend to, you know, take good care of our plants, but overwatering can really do that. Or they're going through a nutrient deficiency. So that means that whatever you put into the ground when you planted your plants, maybe that's all gone, or maybe that wasn't enough, or maybe the plant is just kind of slowly starving. I'm assuming that when you planted the plant, it was fluffy soil and it was, you know, good soil. But yeah, that would be it.
Well, we've had a lot of rain, so that could be something said about that also. Now, since they're in pots, what would you suggest for fertilizing that soil organically?
Compost. Always compost.
Always compost.
Worm casting, vermicompost. a typical 5-3-2 organic chicken manure meal or something like that. You know, the most nightshades, most plants really, what you want to do is in the first 30 days establish the leaf systems, okay? Because plants, how they work is that they'll root. Once they're rooted after transplant, then they'll put their energy to create their canopy, and it's like their solar panels, okay? So if you want to grow really big solar panels so that the plant has a lot of energy, and then it takes that energy back into fruits or to whatever else it's, you know, it's growing. And so the first 30 days or 40 days, depending on crops, 40 days being more tomatoes, it's really important to give them nitrogen. Because nitrogen, NPK, like the nitrogen is the N, that's the one that gives them the energy they need to grow big leaves. And then once that's established, then that's not what you want to give them anymore. And then that's why in most of our plantings, it's a mix of compost. Like a compost is like a 1-1-1. And then we supplement with a 5-3-2 organic chicken meal. And then so the plants get the fast-acting nitrogen. And then after 30 days, when that's done, then the compost is there to feed them with whatever they want and need. So that's a little trick.
Ah, that sounds good. We are talking with Jean-Martin Fortier on Garden Talk today. We'll be back with him in just a bit. If you want to join in, it looks like our phones are all busy, but you can send an email, ideas@wpr.org. This is Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau, filling in for Larry Mueller today. Join us again on Monday, starting at 11. Our physical therapy guests will be back with us to talk about shoulder pain. That's Monday on the Ideas Network. And right now we are talking about organic vegetable gardening. And let's go to Dave in Madison. He's got a question that you may not be familiar with, JM, but Dave, tell him about it.
Hi, Jill, and I've been enjoying your show so far. Yes, so I do have a garden in my backyard, and I do use quite a bit of straw mulch. And my question is, let me back up. So I have discovered a new species of worm. It's a jumping worm, and it's in the soil. It's a highly invasive species. And it's very prolific. I'm usually in favor of, you know, having that good straw mulch, you know, to sort of create that environment for the worms and other, you know, life that's down there. But I'm learning that it's creating a really great breeding environment for these jumping worms. And apparently it can leave soil in this coffee-like texture, and it's supposed to be really bad for the plant life. Do you know much about the jumping worms, and do you know what to expect with this sort of soil depletion?
JM, are you familiar with the jumping worms up in Quebec?
No, and I hope that they won't jump our way.
Yes, you don't want them. You don't want
wow.
them. We have talked about those a number of times on the show. Madison is a hotbed for jumping worms, and they're starting to crawl their way out into different areas of the state, and they can devastate soil. Dave, I would suggest, again, you can talk with your extension, but when we talk to Lisa Johnson, who's pretty much an expert on that. There's not a whole lot you can do, but I would suggest that you maybe give her a call at the extension. She can help you out there. I know that the UW Arboretum has been having problems with them for a long, long time too. So there are some sources that maybe can then help you out with that. But oh, they're nasty. They are nasty. So thanks for the call, Dave. Let's go on to Christina in Glenwood. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you. I do container gardening. I began with organic soil. I'm growing herbs, tomatoes, kale, collards, and peppers. Now, I was going to ask you if you could recommend an organic fertilizer and pesticide. However, I did hear you say, you mentioned chicken meal. I'm wondering, are you referring to chicken manure?
Yeah, chicken manure.
Chicken manure, okay.
Dehydrated chicken manure. Dehydrated is very important because you need to burn all the possible pathogens that would be in fresh manure. And so that's usually what you'll find at your local garden center is chicken manure, dehydrated chicken manure.
That would follow that 30-day nitrogen that you use initially and then go with the dehydrated chicken manure.
You put both. You put your chicken manure and your compost at the same time with your plant. And okay. But it's just if you're only feeding your plants with compost, it's usually not it doesn't kick enough for the plants to really grow fast. It's going to grow long and it's going to grow well, and that's what you want. It's just like compost is the mother of all, you know, amendments. It's the best. There's nothing. Sure. It's that's how, you know, we're compost. We're going to go back to earth, and that's what we're going to be, compost, and that's how it is. But plants, you know, you want to be feeding the soil and feeding the plant. That's why the chicken manure.
Okay. Well, thank you for the call, Christina. Appreciate that. Next up is David in Monona. Hi, David. What's your question?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question I don't know if you're familiar with, but I have a magnolia tree in our garden. And it has magnolia scale on it this year. And I don't know if you've heard of it or any suggestions what to do with it, but it's starting to affect the tree.
Sure. JM, do you have any, I mean, you probably have experience with scale, but on a magnolia?
You know, the honeydew kind of substance that's there?
I'm assuming that. Is that right, David? Do you have that sticky substance on the tree?
On the each little branch, you got these little round white things, and then and there's the bug, and then it rains down this honeydew as a result of the, it's a horrible mess.
Yeah, that's scale. So I'm sure you've dealt with that before, Jean-Martin.
Yeah, it's, you know, for us, it's about, you know, magnolias are harder to grow here.
Right.
But it's, you know, if you can find a natural insecticide, That's how we control that.
So, any suggestions for him? Like brand names or just?
I don't really like to give specific pesca because whatever, if something happens and then Dave calls me and say, hey, my magnolia is dead.
It's all your fault.
So I want to be careful like that. But.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, David, I think if you go to a good nursery and explain what's going on, they probably can recommend something for you on that scale. And I believe PJ Leash was with us on Wednesday, and I think he talked about scale a little bit, too. So if you want to go on WPR.org/Larry and look at our shows from this week, again, it was Wednesday, PJ did mention something about scale, so that could help you out there.
I would perhaps say neem oil.
Neem oil, sure.
Yeah. Okay. If you can find it, neem oil would work.
Okay. There you go. Thank you. Thank you, JM. Let's go to another David up in the UP. Hi, David. What question do you have?
Hello. Hi. My question has to do with pruning off the sucker growth on tomatoes. Now, my tomatoes have been in for probably seven weeks now. They're just like about up to my neck. They're racked up. I got straw mulch on the ground. They're just full of blossoms. Should I cut off all that sucker growth that has blossoms on it or not?
Ooh, what's your opinion on that one?
Well, that's a really great question, and there's different growers will tell you different ways to do this, but I usually end up pruning the first fruit cluster. So the first cluster that would give you fruits, I prune it off. The reason I do that is that the plant will take more of its energy to, instead of growing fruits, it's going to grow more roots, and so you'll have, you know, stronger plants and more yielding plants down the road. So the first cluster, I take it out. So the cluster is where the flowers form, and then eventually that forms the fruit. So that's not the sucker, that's the cluster. So I take that out, and once I do that, then I prune all of the suckers. And depending on the variety of tomatoes that I grow, I sometimes trim the flower clusters. I'll sometimes take one cluster out of two out. It really depends on the size of the tomato you want and if they're cherry or not. But most suckers will go. And you want to do them when they're small, and you want to do them when it's a sunny day, because whenever you're cutting down a tomato plant, cutting out, it kind of, the wound is how pathogens can go inside. So it needs to scar as fast as possible. So whenever you're doing these things, never on a wet day, always on a sunny day, and the more frequent, the better, pruning your tomatoes.
Okay, well, good luck with that, David, and let us know if that works out for you. It's always interesting to hear what people say about the tomato pruning subject. So if you've got a question about organic vegetable gardening or maybe some general gardening question, give us a call. The number, 800-642-1234. And, of course, you can always email us. It's ideas@wpr.org. And we do have a few emails here, so let's get a couple of those. Deb in Plymouth emailed to ask for suggestions on controlling cucumber beetles. She said she's been grabbing them with needle nose pliers.
I think, Jill, we're making a great team here, don't you think?
Sure. Absolutely. Let's go on the road.
we're solving the people's problem. I really like this. It's the first time I do this.
Yeah, absolutely. This is what we're here for every Friday and Saturday. So, yeah.
Okay. Well,
so cucumber beetles.
I will give her my best tip.
Okay.
So the cucumber beetles, they end up nesting or sleeping inside the flowers at night. So what you want to do is really early in the morning, you want to that's especially true on squash. So summer squash, winter squash, cucumbers also, but mostly for squash, they're in the big flowers, and you can have 10 to 15 in each flowers. And so what you do, you come in the morning, you sneak in with a blowtorch. You know these hand torches that you have?
Really? Sure.
And then you just open inside the flower, give it a flame and give it a shot, and then you burn them. And then you just go from flower to flower like that and burn them off.
Oh my God. Doesn't it hurt the flowers?
It doesn't.
Wow.
Yeah, and you want to concentrate on the male flowers, because these won't be bearing fruits.
Okay.
We'll see a rapid decline in the infestation if you do that every day.
Wow, that's interesting and so violent.
Yeah, but it's fun.
Sure it is. Because absolutely.
it's a very practical way to, because you know, they're quite invasive. They can spread really fast, or put an insect net over your crops, which we always do. Whenever we're doing a new planting, there's an insect net over it. But once they start to flower, you need to remove the nets, because they need to be pollinated if they're going to bear fruit.
Sure.
And that's when you expose the plants to the beetle.
Well, it sounds much more efficient than grabbing each one with a needle nose pliers. So,
well,
yeah.
Different firepower.
That's right. Absolutely. Now, you said the different, you know, to try to focus in on the male ones. Now, how can you tell the difference between the male and the female blossoms when you're doing
the
that?
Males one have a long stem, a longer stem, and the females ones are closer to the plant.
Ah, okay. Great.
Yeah. I think in French they're called pistils. I don't know how you
pistils.
Say that in English.
Here they're pistils. So pretty much the same. We probably stole it from the French. Who knows? Okay, great. Well, thanks, Deb. Appreciate that. And Steve emailed to ask, when using a broad fork, how do you incorporate compost into the garden soil?
You don't.
Okay. Sprinkle it on top?
You sprinkle it on top, and then you gently rake it. It wants to be like not incorporated really far. You're better to layer compost year after year than to put it down. If you do want to be kind of putting organic amendments inside the soil, you should be growing cover crops. And then the roots that decay is what feeds the subsoil. And so compost just slightly mix with a rake is just is good enough.
And that's after you use the broad fork to break up the ground a little bit. So it's kind of mixing
and
it in the top.
And if people want to see a really good broad fork, they can visit Growers and Co. These are the people that make the best broad fork. And it's growers.co. And then they'll see what a really good broad fork, a professional broad fork is.
Okay. Yeah. And I did go on the internet real quick to take a look at them. And I've never seen anything like that. So it's they're not cheap, but they look like they would do a really, really good job. So good suggestion. I'll bet you the sales are going to go up, JM. We've been talking about organic vegetable gardening with Jean-Martin Fortier. He is a farmer, educator, and award-winning author of the best-selling book, The Market Gardener. And you can find out more about him by going to his website, themarketgardener.com. And there's lots of information out there for you. I'm Jill Nadeau. I'm in for Larry Mueller. Stay with us. There's always more to come. You're listening to Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks for spending some of your day with us on the Ideas Network. Jean-Martin Fortier is with us today. He's a farmer, educator, and award-winning author of the bestseller, The Market Gardener. He's inspired many to embrace a vision of agriculture that is human scale, ecological, and profitable. How's your garden looking this year? What veggies are giving you trouble? Do you have questions about our organic gardening? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to wpr.org. Jam, I had mentioned your website before we went to the news. Why don't you tell us a little bit about it? Because I really enjoyed taking a look at it.
TheMarketGardener.com is my website because when I launched my book, it became really popular. And then I was asked to give a lot of workshops, which I did. And then I did that in Canada, and then I did that in the U.S., and then in Australia, New Zealand, and then Europe. And then
that's great.
It just started. But everybody kept inviting me and kept wanting to learn more about what I was doing and why. And so I just kept. And then eventually, you know, the website became a space where people would always write me, okay, where do you get these tools? Where do you get that? How do you do this? And so just started to populate the website with more information about how to buy stuff or why this and why not. Because I'm a consultant for a lot of different tool companies out there.
Ah, okay.
And so that's where I share a lot of that information. And then eventually, Jill, I started to teach an online course to professional market gardeners that wanted to take their farming to a new level. So it's not a gardening course. It's really for professional, you know, market gardeners. But I did that, and that's also part of the website. And that's the website.
Okay. Well, I suggest that people take a look at it. And I think you have links to get your book there also if you want to go through that way. We have open lines, so if anybody has any gardening questions, give us a call, 800-642-1234. We did have Paul email us. We had talked earlier with a listener who thought maybe her potted tomatoes had blight, but we were talking about maybe it was too much water and not enough nutrients. But he wanted to share that at this time of year, early blight of tomatoes is a very common disease that starts with small brown spots on the lower leaves, followed by browning of the entire leaf and then leaf drop. He says that the University of Wisconsin has an excellent publication on it at the disease clinic. So for those who think they might have some form of blight, there's another reference. Have you had a problem with blight at all, JM?
Yeah, it depends on the years, but it's definitely possible. We tend to grow a lot of our nightshades under plastic, like in a caterpillar or a carport. People could relate to that.
Sure.
You know, we just put the carport outside in the garden, and we cover it with UV treated plastic, and then we grow them in there. And so, you know, most tomatoes, peppers, eggplants, when their leaves are wet, that's when they're susceptible to blight and all sorts of other diseases. And that, so you want to keep them as dry. That's why in California, you don't have that a lot.
Right. Well, that makes sense. That makes sense. Yeah. Okay. Well, let's go back to the phones. We've got Renee on the line, and she's in Madison. Hi, Renee.
Hello.
What can we help you with?
I planted a pawpaw tree last year, and this year it has quite a few leaves, maybe about 30, but I'm having lots of holes appearing in them. One day I found a little tiny worm, but I keep looking, I don't see any, and now I see ants on the tree. I'm wondering if the ants are going to come and clean up the worms and solve my problem.
Well, that would be nice. What do you think, JM?
Well, I'm not really familiar with pawpaw trees, so I think I'll leave you that, Jill, I'll leave you this one.
Oh, thanks a lot. Actually, well, it turns out I do have some experience with pawpaw trees, but I grew them for quite a few years and got some blossoms finally and never got a pawpaw. Apparently, I didn't have the right, I wasn't attracting the correct insect to do the pollination. But I did not have any problems with holes and ants. So I'm not really sure what to tell you, Renee. Again, I hate to pawn everything off on Lisa Johnson at the Extension, but I think she would probably be the person to talk to. Unless anybody out there listening has had pawpaw trees with holes and ants, that would probably help her out. So good luck, Renee, and thank you so much. Let's go now to Roger in Milwaukee. It sounds like he's got a problem with Japanese beetles. Roger?
Hello.
Yeah, what's up?
Well, we've been in the house now for, this is our third season. And the last 2 years, the Japanese beetles showed up in June. And, I'd be out there with the spray soap, insecticidal soap. But I'm looking for, and this year they did not show up until mid-July for whatever reason. But is there something I can do to, I have a plum tree, a cherry tree, a couple crabapple trees, and then, of course, the nightshade plants, eggplant and tomato.
Have you been having any problems with Japanese beetles in Quebec?
They are incredible, eh? When they start to come, I have a horror story because our farm is near a vineyard, and we wanted to create a windbreak, so we planted a really big windbreak, and then we planted vines over it so that it wouldn't be ugly.
Uh huh.
But you know, the Japanese beetle, they just wouldn't want to let the vines grow.
No.
And actually, I really don't never know. You know, they sell those bags with pheromones.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And you attract them by the truckload.
Mm-hmm.
I keep hearing that. I'm not sure that that's a good strategy or not, because you're attracting them with the pheromones.
We've heard the same thing from a number of people in the last year or two, that it's not a great idea, even though it looks like it's working really well. They're just coming in from places where, you know, they're not your yard. So, yeah. We've heard so many things, Roger, about the Japanese beetles from our entomologists, from gardeners, and everybody's got their own way of doing it. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. I try yelling at them at the top of my voice, but it doesn't seem to help, so I wouldn't do that. I don't know. What do you do when you get them in your garden, JM?
I don't. Oh. I only got them for the vines. So
okay, okay.
I guess am I touching wood here?
Really, yeah, lucky. You better. I was wondering the same thing, because I did notice that I had some wild grapevine growing in part of my garden. The Japanese beetles were eating those like crazy, and I thought, well, should I just leave it there for them to eat that so they won't eat my other stuff? So maybe it is one of those things. Good luck, Roger. I wish we had some better answers for you. If someone comes up with an idea, they will be a millionaire for sure. So thanks for the call. Let's go now to Esther, and she's in Grays Lake, Illinois. Hi, Esther. What can we help you with?
Hi. I am growing various vegetables in containers, large containers. And my cucumbers suddenly look really droopy, and the leaves are turning yellow, and they were doing so well. I'm not sure what's happened. And so in addition to that, though, I've noticed just in the past day or so a lot of flies buzzing around the cucumber plants as well.
What but kind of flies are they? Esther, do you know what kind of flies they are?
I have no idea.
So basically insects of some sort.
Yeah, but they look like a house fly.
Okay.
I mean, like a little...
Jean-Martin, do you sound... Is this another too much water
Esther,
thing?
Well, it could be. It could always... It is definitely one of the most common things. Like once... If the roots are swogged with water, bogged with water, then it just opens the space for this to happen. Have you seen, Esther, have you seen, are the plants kind of wilting and dying, or is it, you know, what are, droopy, tell me more about droopy.
the leaves are not, they're not upright anymore. They're kind of, they're wilting.
Yeah, they're wilting. Well, I'll tell you, the cucumber beetle is one that spreads a virus in the cucumber plants. So it's the tomato, it's the wilt, and that's another possibility that I've seen a lot. So fortunately, you want to perhaps make sure that you have any cucumber beetles. They're yellow. They have yellow stripes on their back. They're big.
No.
You can really see yellow black.
I have not noticed anything aside any kind of insects besides the flies suddenly are very attracted to the plant.
What kind of drainage do you have, Esther?
Well, it's in a big pot, a big clay pot, big, very large pot.
Okay.
And so it's got the holes, you know, on the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And I, if I recall, I think I put broken clay pieces down underneath before I put the soil. It's very, because they're doing so well. And then, all at once, from going to that dark, dark green leaf to very pale and yellowy.
Take one plant out. Take the whole plant out and look at your roots and see if they're wet.
Ah, okay. So maybe I'm watering too much. Would I be watering and not enough drainage? Is that okay?
That's
all right.
Whenever we say not enough drainage, that means that the water is not percolating in the soil. So it's ponding in the root zone, and that's what creates problems. So the roots, they don't want to be wet all the time. So that's a simple way you'll find out if your plants are dying. Then whatever, you want to throw them in the garbage. Also, when you start to have wilt like that, don't throw them in your compost pile, throw them in the garden. So if ever it's a virus, which happens, then you're not spreading it in your compost.
Great to note that. Thank you, Esther. Next we have Laura, and she's in Eau Claire County. Hi, Laura.
Hi. Thanks for the show today.
You bet. What's going on?
It's a carrot question. I planted some, I think they were Nantes, N-A-N-T-E-S, in early June.
Yes. They're the best.
They are, okay. Oh, they're the best? Okay. Well,
yeah, they're the best.
They're having a hard time. The seeds sparsely grew, and they're just kind of slowly coming along, and I don't know. Is it just they're not growing like I was hoping they would? Do they need something that they're not getting?
No. If they're still at the tiny stage, they don't need anything. It just takes time. You know, carrots is like 70 days, 75 days. So you just need to plant some more so that you'll have... once they start to kick in, you'll have more, because the carrots, you don't want to have just one shot. You want to have many, many, many different shots, because the nantes, they're really good fresh. Like you take them out of the garden and boom, you eat them right there. They're not storage carrots. You know, you don't want to keep them for the whole winter. So plant some more and be patient.
Yeah, because it does take a while for carrots. It's a little bit more slow growing, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, it does. It's like 75.
Yep, yeah. 75 days. That's a long time.
Okay. All right. Yeah, it is.
Okay.
Thanks for your help.
Thanks, Laura. Yeah, bye-bye. Next up, we've got Bob, and he is in West Jacksonport. Hi, Bob.
All right. Thanks for taking my call. My garden here got flooded really heavily in late June or so, and all the nutrients went through everything. My pepper plants are small bushes, and they seem to have suckers, you know, analogous to tomato plants. They're bushy, thick, very tall. What is the best way to manage those at this time?
Jan?
Well, is it waterlogged because of there's too much rain? Is that what I'm hearing?
We got an industrial pump. Everything's dry, good drainage right now. The plants just look beautiful, dark green, really lush, lots of flower buds, but they're very compact, maybe a foot and a half tall, but just very thick.
So your basic question is should you do something about them being bushy? Is that correct?
It looks as though there's just no room there. There's so much foliage.
All right. What do you think? Is that a bad thing? Or
no, usually when plants start to bush up, it's not such a bad thing. You know, I can only kind of relate to when we do it in greenhouses. Like when you have not enough light and a lot of warm temperature, that's what it does. And so perhaps it's just like, I don't know what the weather pattern has been for the last, you know, 4 weeks where you are,
mm-hmm.
Bob, but, you know, it might just be like the natural state of affairs at this time. And then it can evolve depending on if the sun starts to come out and then it's warm again, or I don't know.
So wait and see. That's pretty much all we can tell you at this point. But I mean, he's got blossoms, so that sounds like a positive thing. All right, let's go then. Thanks, Bob, for the call. Let's go to Jill in Racine. Hi, Jill.
Hi. I've had Japanese beetles. They even went after sunflowers. And I took a bucket of just dish soap. I've got a decent dish soap and water, and I just washed the tops of them, and the Japanese beetles are gone. They went after a tree and other things. I hope they don't come back. Another friend takes a bucket of dish soapy water and just plucks them all off and puts them in the bucket. I just washed the entire plant and they're gone.
Okay, thank you, Jill, which you can do with a sunflower a little bit more than you can with some small, delicate flower. But have you used the dish soap method at all, Jean-Martin?
Nope, I haven't, but yeah. I took note.
Okay. We've had a number of people call about that, and that they do. They just pick them off by hand, throw them in the soapy water, and that will get rid of them. But it is time consuming. So thanks for the call, Jill. Let's go to Dan in Duluth, Minnesota. Hi, Dan.
Hello. Thanks for the program.
Sure.
It's been interesting. I just wanted to get back, quick question, back to the beginning. You had a book called Market Farmer or...
Market Gardener.
Oh, okay. Well, I was wondering if making it on a 2-acre farm was possible because you had a successful book or...
Oh.
That's a great question.
It is a very good question.
Yeah. No, the book had nothing to do with the success of the garden because I was writing, about the success in the book. So one came after the other. And still today, so I've started another farm. So I now work on another piece of land, and my wife runs the farm without me. She says it's much better ever since I left the farm. She's the boss. She decides everything. And that acre and a half has been in production for now 16 years.
Wow.
And she makes a really good living off the land. She has 3 months off. she has about 200 families that really appreciate her work and that thank her, you know, at night when the veggies come back. And she, you know, she gets, they always say to her, you know, you're included in our prayers. And so she's really getting a lot of good vibes from her work. It's working financially, it's working ecologically, and it's just like it's a proof of concept. And the my whole goal in the last, I would say, perhaps 10 years has been to spread the word about it so that others could do it and have a happy life. And then my whole message, Jill and others, is that I think that farming, industrial farming, is a catastrophe for the environment, the world, our health, and we need to replace mass production with production by the masses, have a lot of small farms, have a lot of home gardeners, and just kind of populate our communities with healthy, vibrant gardens that are growing great food, and that's what I care about.
Well, I think that's wonderful advice. And Dan, thank you so much for asking about that. Just really quickly before we have to go, what kind of plants can people start right now at this time of year? You had mentioned carrots.
Yeah, you can go till Christmas with plants. If you're putting the carport outside, spinach, radishes, you can still do turnips, all crops that are 50 days or less.
Mm-hmm.
You still have lots of time to put them in the ground.
Okay.
And when I talk days, 50 days, I've used that word a lot. You know, when you open seed catalogs, you'll see the number of days before the crop gets to maturity.
Mm-hmm.
And days to maturity, DTM, this is a great little indicator of what you can do when.
Ah, perfect. And when you're talking about carports, you're really talking about we call it like a hoop house, where it's a covered area that you put your plants under. Right?
Yeah, but yeah. I see them in the city, in the suburbs, all everywhere in mm-hmm. front of the, and I'm saying, this is all wrong. They should be in the back. It's not the car that needs a greenhouse. It's the tomato
it's plants. The tomato plants. That's right. Well, we have to have carports because most people don't have room in their garages. So, you know, that's kind of where it goes. So,
okay.
All right. Well, it has been just a joy to talk with you today, Jean-Martin. How is your garden growing this year? Everything doing well?
Yeah, it didn't get the virus, so we're good.
And excellent.
Plants are not complaining, and customers are happy. And
what more could
you
ask
farming
for?
It's never easy, but it's always enjoyable.
Absolutely wonderful. Well, thank you again so much. Our guest today on Garden Talk has been Jean-Martin Fortier. He is a farmer, educator, and award-winning author of the bestseller, The Market Gardener. And you can find more about him at themarketgardener.com. I hope you can join us on Monday when we're going to talk about shoulder pain with our physical therapist. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks for listening to the Ideas Network. Stay well, stay cool, and enjoy your weekend.